Good afternoon. And welcome to Theodore Parker Church. My name is Anne Bancroft. I'm honored to serve as the 29th minister of this congregation, founded in 1712. A small bit of history for those of you less familiar with our congregation. We began as the Second Church of Roxbury long before the neighborhoods were annexed. It later became the first parish of West Roxbury in 1854. The congregation split in the late 19th century, half moving to Roslindale and half coming to the church built on this site. Most recently in 1962, the re-merged members chose to name their congregation the Theodore Parker Unitarian Church, honoring their seventh minister, the Reverend Theodore Parker. Parker had served what was then the Second Church of Roxbury from 1837 to 1846. And while today's standards might find fault with some of the perspectives that were not inconsistent with his day, he is yet understood to have been, according to biographer John White Chadwick, involved with almost all of the reform movements of the time: peace, temperance, education, the condition of women, penal legislation, and prison discipline, though none became a dominant factor in his experience, with the exception of his anti-slavery views. He led the local movement against the Fugitive Slave Act, sheltering fugitive slaves in his own home. Over the course of his ministries, Parker and his words inspired people. He inspired Abraham Lincoln, for example, to utilize the phrase "of the people, for the people, and by the people." He inspired Martin Luther King Jr. to paraphrase Parker's own words into King's well-known suggestion that the moral arc of the universe bends towards justice. And he has inspired the members of this congregation to worship and learn and act on behalf of justice for many, many years. We are pleased you are with us this afternoon. We so look forward to the inspiration of the words that our fourth guest lecturer brings to us. I am so grateful to Samer Nasruddin for joining us today. Congregation member and chair of this year's lecture team, Kevin Murray, will introduce our speaker more fully.
Good afternoon. Good to see everybody here. I have the very pleasant job of introducing today's speaker. But first of all, I want to take a second, to thank you all for being here this afternoon, to make the effort to be with us on this fine fall day. It's great to see lots of familiar faces out there. It's even more affirming to see some faces that are less familiar. Welcome, everyone. If today's event leaves you curious, don't be a stranger. Our house is your house. I also want to just offer a couple of reminders before I get started. One is there are two exits from here, as you can see by the red signs. These two doors here are the rear exit from the congregation. You can also go out this door here. And we hope most of you will go out this door here, because after this event, we're going to have a little reception in the parish hall with our speaker, and we hope you'll join us for that. This morning in our service, Reverend Ann told us all that the theme for this month is hope. The theme comes from a circle, a spiritual circle that she's involved in. I thought it's a particularly appropriate theme. Samer Nasruddin is an emerging leader in our community in Boston, the kind of leader who offers us the opportunity to hope. To give us hope for the future at a time when hope in the future is really needed. Samer came to Boston in 2016 from Arizona to become the director of the Muslim American Society Youth Programs at the Islamic Society of Boston Cultural Center, that beautiful center located right outside of Roxbury Crossing. While in Arizona, he studied psychology at Arizona State University, where he was active in the local Muslim community as a youth leader and organizer. In his current work at ISBCC, he serves youth active in the mosque and also works to connect Muslim student groups at local universities with a cultural center. Since arriving in Boston, Samer has become the Muslim spiritual advisor at Northeastern University and the Muslim co-chaplain at MIT. He is currently on a path to further study and a career in the counseling field. In a week in which the President of the United States committed what many people consider to be an anti-Muslim hate crime on Twitter, Samer's message to us is particularly timely. Please join me in welcoming the fourth annual Theodore Parker Lecturer, Samer Nasiruddin.
In the name of God, the most gracious, the most merciful, we ask God to send an abundance of peace and blessings and salutations upon our beloved messengers, all of upon whom be peace, beginning with Adam, to Abraham, to Moses, to Jesus, to Muhammad. Peace and blessings be upon all of them. We ask God to send an abundance of peace upon them and upon their families and upon their communities and upon all those who follow in their footsteps. And we hope that we're amongst that group. I want to thank you guys so much, beginning with thanking my dear friend Kevin, who we've coordinated this moment for quite some time now. It feels like it's been four or five months. Thank Reverend Ann for your gracious hospitality and for all of you for being here and welcoming me and putting up with me, really. What I'd like to do to start off is really make sure that we're all on the same page. And what I mean by that is that I'm going to be speaking about Islam and the beloved community and what that really looks like from an Islamic framework, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s really vision of a global community, shared humanity, where we can all live and prosper together from an Islamic framework, looking at the model community that our dear Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings be upon him, he built in his time, 1400 years ago, the community of Medina. But before I really jump into that, we need to make sure that we're all on the same wavelength when we're speaking about Islam. So I want to go ahead and just give a brief summary to answer the question, what is Islam? So that we all know, because if I asked 10 people, what is Islam, I'd get probably maybe 10 different answers. So Islam, in a nutshell, is really all about loving surrender. Loving surrender to Almighty God. Now, you guys all know in English, if you think back to your, fourth grade, fifth grade studies, we all know that English words, they all have roots from other languages, the German and Latin and French, etc., etc. So understanding the root word or where a word comes from often gives us more insight into a concept or an idea. And so Islam means loving surrender, and you might have heard that Islam means peace. You ever heard Islam means peace before? No? Well, it's often something that you'll hear, and that's actually not exactly right. It's actually that the root word of Islam is peace. And so we can use this insight to give a little bit more color to that working definition of what Islam is. So Islam is all about loving surrender to Almighty God in pursuit of that peace. And what kind of peace are we in pursuit of? We're in pursuit of peace with God, first and foremost. We're in pursuit of peace with humanity, our brothers and sisters in humanity. And we're in pursuit of peace within our hearts, that inner tranquility and contentment that we're all longing for and searching for. And so that is really what Islam is at its core. And Islam, to really further understand it, can be broken down into what is Islam, the question of what is Islam. It can be broken down into three things. The first thing is, what do Muslims, what does Islam, what are the things that you have to do as a Muslim? So what do you do? The second question of what do you believe and why do you believe? And number three is, what do you embody? And this, we learn this from a prophetic tradition of the Prophet, peace and blessings be upon him, in which the archangel Gabriel came to him in front of his companions in the form of a man, and he asked him these three questions: what is Islam, what is Iman, and what is Ihsan? And the Prophet, peace and blessings be upon him, he illustrated what these three things were, and that was a means of communicating and teaching his companions that were with him and all of humanity until the rest of time. And so Islam is really is really what you do. And those are, you might have heard that Muslims have five pillars of Islam. The first one, that you bear witness and testify that there is no deity worthy of worship except the one true God, and that Muhammad is the messenger of God. This is a proclamation, a testimony that Muslims make. It's also what a person would, if they were to convert to Islam, they would say this proclamation. So everyone can go ahead and repeat after me. Ashhadu. No, I'm kidding. That was a bad joke. So this is the first of our core pillars of Islam. And then others that you might have heard of, that Muslims pray five times a day, that Muslims give a charity and almsgiving, that Muslims fast. Yes, we're that crazy. We fast in the month of Ramadan from sun up until sundown. We abstain from eating and drinking, and that we make a pilgrimage to Mecca. That is what we do. What is it that we believe? We believe in six core articles of faith. That is, we believe in God, we believe in His angels, we believe in His revelations or His divine scriptures sent down to us. We believe in the messengers of God that came with those scriptures to deliver that message. We believe in the day of judgment and heaven and a hell. We believe in predestination, something that I presume is much of it is a common shared belief within this space. So that is what Muslims believe. And number three is, what is it that Muslims try to embody or cultivate within ourselves? And that is the concept of ihsan. And this is the oft neglected part of Islam that doesn't make its way into general discourse when it comes to the subject of Islam. So what is ihsan? Ihsan, the Prophet, peace and blessings be upon him, he taught us that ihsan is that you worship God as if you see Him. And if you can't see Him, that at the very least you know that He sees you. And so what that means is that I come with a spirit knowing that God is watching me in this moment. And as a result of that knowledge, it inspires me to try to embody a spirit of beauty and excellence in everything that I do. A spirit of beauty and excellence in everything that I do. And so this is, if anyone asks you what is Islam, now you know. You got a brief summary, and that's really what Islam is all about. So I just wanted to give that preface before I jump into the subject matter of my lecture today. And that is Islam and the Beloved Community, which I mentioned was from Dr. King's vision of a beloved community with which is a global vision in which all people share in the wealth of the earth. In the beloved community, poverty, hunger, and homelessness will not be tolerated because international standards of human decency will not allow it. Racism and all forms of discrimination, bigotry, and prejudice will be replaced by an all-inclusive spirit of brotherhood and sisterhood. And so this idea of beloved community, we want to foster a community that is beloved. Beloved to whom? Beloved to God, first and foremost. Beloved to humanity. We want to foster this ethos and this spirit and this community, but how do we do it? You know, we believe as Muslims that there are enough resources on this earth for everyone not only to live a good life, but to live a great life. To live a great life. It's just a matter of distribution of resources and distribution of wealth. But to approach this subject of Dr. King's vision of this shared humanity that leads to this beloved community, I am approaching it from a different lens and a different angle. And that is that there are three core challenges to a beloved community coming to be. The first of those challenges is economic inequality and economic disparity that would exist between a society. And in this modern world that we live in, that comes in the shape and form of capitalism. And so in this, you know, what recently you see the GOP bill that is being pushed to lower taxes for the rich and to lower taxes for big corporations. And of course the rhetoric is that it's going to be beneficial for middle class, and we know that's not the case. And so this world that we live in, which pushes this economic disparity, is one of the challenges that prevents that beloved community from coming to form. And so what I want to do is look at these three challenges, and we'll come to the others, through the lens of the prophetic community that Muhammad, peace and blessings be upon him, the Muslims' last and final prophet and messenger, that what he built and how he built a beloved community in his time and place. And so we find that the Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings be upon him, he flipped the narrative on its head. And what he taught was that true wealth is wealth of the heart. That true wealth is wealth of the heart. And that in this day and age, in this modern world that we live in this country that we hold so dear, in which we all have heard of the idea of the pursuit of happiness, that we all long for this pursuit of happiness. What that has transformed into in this day and age is unfortunately the pursuit of wealth, of material wealth. And that is a reality that we, if we do not address and come back to our roots of pursuing happiness and not pursuing material wealth, then we will not be able to achieve that beloved community. Because pursuing happiness is not synonymous with pursuing material wealth. Pursuing happiness is an endeavor that begins with aligning ourselves and finding that peace with God. And that it's that peace with God that allows us to have peace with others, with our fellow brethren in humanity. And that's what really allows us to then live for something greater than ourselves, to live for something beyond our own self-interests and our own agendas. And that's what leads a person to finding contentment and tranquility and purpose and meaning. And so our Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings be upon him, he came with this message, and that it comes in the form, simply, in one of the five core pillars of Islam. And that is the almsgiving. That as Muslims, you have an obligation to give 2.5% of your excess wealth to charity. And that charity is a specific charity that would go to ensure that every single person in that society has their basic needs met and taken care of food and water and shelter and peace and security. And so this reality is something that the Prophet came to address, this inequality that, just like is present in our time, we know that there's a 1% of our society that holds much, at least 70 to 80% of this country's capital and material wealth. That just like we face that reality, Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings be upon him, came and faced that same reality. And he put institutions in place like this almsgiving that would serve as a means of, number one, removing what is the second challenge to building a beloved community, which is individualism and egocentrism that is often present within our hearts. And so it is a form of charity that you give not only to benefit someone else, but you also give it to benefit your own self, because it's a purification. That's actually the word zakah. I mentioned root words before. I guess I like to talk about root words. Root word of zakah comes from to purify. And so this zakah, this charity that we give, is a means of purification for our own wealth and also for our own hearts, to rid our hearts of the individualism that may exist within it. So that leads me to this second challenge of building a beloved community. And that is the idea that any sort of religion that is tied to God, and that God looks upon it with an eye of pleasure, is a religion that is not elitist. Spirituality that is pleasing to God can never be elitist. And we find this manifested in a beautiful story of the Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings be upon him, in which, to give you some background, the Prophet Muhammad came from a community in which, when he started to deliver his message of loving surrender to God in pursuit of peace, what I mentioned earlier, he found that it wasn't well received. And his own family, his own tribe, his own people, they weren't so pleased with that narrative. And they pushed back and they oppressed the Prophet, peace and blessings be upon him, and his people. And so for 13 years, the Prophet, peace and blessings be upon him, lived in Mecca, in his hometown where he was born and raised. Everything that he knew, he only knew Mecca. and his people persecuted him, and it was very difficult upon him and his followers. And it came to a point where he was seeking aid, he was seeking help, he was seeking the allyship of key leaders that would turn the tide and that would be institutional figures that would help his message really sink in within that community. And so the Prophet, peace and blessings be upon him, his uncle, his dearest uncle, was the leader of that tribe. And he wasn't Muslim. And many of the other kind of chieftains, the leaders with a lot of social capital, a lot of political capital, they came to the Prophet's uncle. And they said, you know, this message of Prophet Muhammad that he's coming with, you know, we're open to it. You know, we kind of like it's starting to resonate within us what he's saying. But there's one problem. And that is that what he's suggesting, what he's putting forth, is that our slaves and our servants and the lower class amongst us, that we are equal, that we are on the same foothold, and that we are to treat others with that in mind. They said, you know, we love all this loving surrender stuff. We love all this prayer and this charity and this fasting. But this idea of equality, we're not down with that. Tell Muhammad that we're open to hearing your message, and we may become Muslim, but only conditionally, only if you compromise on this. Just throw this one strand out. Just cross that line out, and we'll be with you. And the Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings be upon him, of course, unconditionally, without compromise, rejected this idea. And God himself actually came down with revelation affirming that message, that it is not for us to ever dictate what God's vision is for humanity, and what is pleasing to God. What motivates and drives our world is not our subjective feelings that I am better than someone, but rather it is what God knows. And what God knows is that each and every one of us as humanity, we are created in God's image, and we are created as equals in that image. The third challenge that I put forth is really a core challenge to building that beloved community is race and racial divide that often permeates our spaces and permeates the society that we live in today, and certainly permeated the society that Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings be upon him, he came to. You know, there's a story of Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings be upon him, of two of his companions, that there was a time where they were discussing war strategy, discussing their approach. I think we should do this. No, I think we should do that. And two companions, one companion, his name is Bilal. He was a black slave from Ethiopia. And he was brought as a slave to that space, and he lived as a slave for many, many years until he was freed from that slavery in Mecca, and now he is in the community of Medina with the Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings be upon him. He's someone that the Prophet, he loved dearly. And it was well known amongst the companions that you don't mess with Bilal because of the love that the Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings be upon him, he had for him. And so, but at one point they were having this disagreement, and another companion by the name of Abu Dharr, basically, when he was disagreeing, he didn't like the fact that Bilal was putting forth his own opinion. And so he said to Bilal, "You disagree with me? How dare you disagree with me, you son of a black woman? How dare you disagree with me, you son of a black woman? How could you think that you could disagree with me?" And he made this bold claim that when the Prophet, peace and blessings be upon him, he heard that this statement was made. He called Abu Dharr and he asked him, And you hear stories, and I grew up hearing stories about the Prophet, peace and blessings be upon him, of how often he was so optimistic and so cheerful, and the love that he emanated at all times. And the Prophet would never become angry for himself, but he would only become angry, he would have a righteous anger for others. And so in this moment, the Prophet, peace and blessings be upon him, he became angry to the point where you could see a vein from his forehead. And he said to Abu Dharr, did you really say this? Did you really put forth this claim that he can't disagree with you, number one, and then you made this racial slur to your brother? And Abu Dharr, he owned up shamefully. He was very embarrassed to be in this circumstance, in this before, you know, that this predicament that he put himself in. And so he owns the mistake, and the Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings be upon him, he says, you know, leave, because you have still remnants of ignorance from the time before Islam. The time before Islam, that was a tribalistic culture. Everything was driven by my family, my tribe, my people. That was the ignorance that was still, the remnants of ignorance that was still left behind. And Abu Dharr, when this happened, he came to Bilal and he put his head on the ground. And he told Bilal, he said, put your foot on my face. He went down to the ground because he wanted to pull the weeds of that ignorance that was within him. So he went down and he told Bilal, put your foot on my head as it's on the ground. And Bilal came to him, and he went down and he kissed his head, and he said, no, you are my brother. I would never put my foot on you. And the Prophet, peace be upon him, when he heard this, he smiled. When he heard of this encounter, he smiled. And he knew that his job was done there. And so we have a very beautiful verse in the Holy Quran, which I'd like to share with you, which really summarizes this essence of diversity and how we need to celebrate diversity. God, he says in the Quran that, يَا أَيُّهَا النَّاسِ إِنَّا خَلَقْنَاكُمْ مِنْ ذَكَرٍ وَأُنْثَى وَجَعَلْنَاكُمْ شُعُوبًا وَقَبَائِلَ لِتَعَارَفُوا إِنَّ أَكْرَمَكُمْ عِنْدَ اللَّهِ أَتْقَاكُمْ. God, he says that, O people, we created you all from a single man and a single woman, and made you into races and tribes so that you should recognize and know one another. Indeed, in God's eyes, the most honored of you are the ones most mindful and conscious of Him. Indeed, God is all-knowing, all-aware. And so what here we find is that God is suggesting and teaching us that He created us in nations and tribes, different from one another. But at the end of the day, we are all from one man and one woman. And that at the end of the day, although we might look different, at the core, we are actually all the same. We are actually all the same, and we have that shared humanity amongst us. But God doesn't stop there. He gives us a metric, though, that we can utilize, that only metric that in God's eyes is meaningful, that differentiates between people. And that is that in God's eyes, the most honored amongst you are the ones most mindful and conscious of Him. This idea of taqwa, God consciousness, or piety. The idea that I know that God is watching me at all times. And so God is always present in my interactions, in my dealings with others. And so really what this verse teaches me personally is God is saying that in order for you to really know, recognize one another, and then to be able to come to know one another, and then ultimately to love one another, is that you must have God in your heart. And that it's actually God in your heart, having God in your heart, is actually inversely proportional with being me-centric and with being self-centered and egotistical and narcissistic. That God is saying that in order for you to have the capacity to actually love others in a meaningful capacity, you have to begin with having me, God, in your heart. And the more that we have God in our hearts, the more capacity that we have to actually come to know and to come to love one another. And so it's this diversity that God wants us to celebrate. Because in Islam, we have this idea that there is the oneness of God and the multiplicity and diversity of creation. And that it's in that diversity of creation that is actually a sign of God. That it's God's mosaic. That He created us all to look and feel sometimes different. But at the end of the day, it's all pointing to the one same thing. And that is God. And that is God's oneness. And so this idea of diversity is one that is central to actually building a beloved community, because it requires us to dig deep and to look beyond our superficial differences and find that shared humanity that we all have, that God put within us. And so in that prophetic community, I'd like to now move to what was the Prophet Muhammad's solution to this reality. These challenges existed. It was a society in which there was a lot of economic disparity. It was a society in which everyone was me-focused and everything was about me and my family. And we find that there's a lot of similitude to the society that we live in which everyone is focused on me. And even it's a transcendent idea in this day and age often to actually care not only about me, but to care about my family and my inner circle. And it's certainly lost to care not only about me and my family, but also to care about my community and moving beyond even my community and to caring and loving humanity. And so an example of this, we find that this balance, this harmony that existed, we find it in God's nature. You go to different ecosystems, whether you're talking about jungles or whether you're talking about coral reefs, you find there's a beautiful harmony in which all of the different animals, they work, you know, in harmony. There's a symbiotic relationship. There's a mutuality to the relationship. There's reciprocity between them. And you find that in the jungle, the trees that are in the high canopy, they don't try to undermine the trees that are closer to the ground. And that the moles and the worms that are under the ground, they don't try to undermine the animals that are above ground. But that there's a harmony. And this is the harmony that we must seek out. This is the harmony that God desired for us. And it only happens when we embody the ultimate measure that Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings be upon him, put forth, that if we live up to this litmus test, then we will find and we will build a beloved community. And if we don't, then we will most likely fail. And the Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings be upon him, he said and he taught humanity that none of you will truly believe until you love for your brother what you love for yourself. The idea that I will take less so that others can have more, so that others can have plenty. And this is exactly what we find the example of Malcolm X. Malcolm X is someone that lived for others to the point where he knew that whenever he was assassinated, he knew that there was a bounty on his head. And he told his bodyguards that he said, "Leave me." Because he didn't want to put them in harm's way. And even bigger than that was that he was ready to die for an ideal that was bigger than himself, because he cared about humanity and he cared about humanity's growth and moving away from the oppressive tyranny of racism and moving to Dr. King's vision of a shared humanity and a global beloved community. And so you find that in the Prophet Muhammad's community, and a good example of this ethos of love, which is really the necessary resource that we must try to build, because love is not just a feeling, but it's something that it takes work. It's something that requires cultivating within us, cultivating it within our hearts, cultivating within our families, and cultivating within our communities. And ultimately, when we build that love, then what it leads to is selflessness and preference of others over oneself. And that is the example of, I mentioned our Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings be upon him, I keep coming back to him, his dearest friend, his name was Abu Bakr. And Abu Bakr was someone that lived for others. But it came to a point where he was finding it difficult to worship God and to live to worship God as he wanted to feel comfortable. But because of the oppression that the people of that city were putting on and the pressures that they were putting on him, he wanted to actually flee to Abyssinia, which many Muslims at the time had already made migration to this other place in Abyssinia. And we'll speak to that in a little bit. And as he was leaving the city, a man who was not Muslim, by the name of Ibn Daghina, he crossed paths as one is leaving the city, and one is coming into the city, and one is leaving. And so they just, you know, converse, and they say, "Where are you going? What are you up to? Where are you headed? You look like you're going somewhere." And he says, "You know, I've had it up to here with all this oppression, and I just want to worship God in peace. And so I'm going to go, and I'm going to go to Abyssinia, where other Muslims were seeking refuge." And he says, No. That's not possible. You, Abu Bakr, if you leave this city, the love and selflessness that you bring to this city, if you leave it, then we're done. We're done for." And he promised him, he was a prominent leader. And so in that world, it's a little bit of an ancient idea, but the idea of protection, of having a tribe or someone, of an important figure, offer protection. So he said, "There's no way you're leaving this city, because you're the one who is the quickest and first to help the needy and to help the orphans. You're the one who honors your guests. You're the one who maintains beautiful relationships with your family." And he listed off a multitude of things that he does, which if they lost Abu Bakr, then there would be no beloved community. That's what that man, he truly understood. If we lose Abu Bakr, the idea of a beloved community is out the window. We need people like him. And so Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings be upon him, he understood that love had to be cultivated. And that love he cultivated through a central idea and a central institution, and that was a word we call mu'akha, which is intentional brotherhood and sisterhood. In which when the Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings be upon him, and his companions moved from Mecca and that oppressive state, and they sought refuge in Medina, and they were well received by that entire community, by the Christians of that community, by the Jews of that community, by the locals, by the local tribes who had then converted to Islam. All three embraced the Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings be upon him. And so there was these two bodies. There are those who left oppression and sought refuge, and there were those that were called the Ansars, the helpers, who received them beautifully. And the Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings be upon him, the first thing he did was build a mosque, an institution that would house a beloved community. And number two, he instituted this mu'akha, which is pairing of one brother with another brother, and one sister with another sister. And this mutual relationship, he was teaching that you have an interconnectedness and an interdependence that is unlike any other. You must love and care and be tender with one another's needs, just as you would be with your own family. Because at the end of the day, that is what you are. You are family. And so he taught, he instituted this, where one person was attached with another person. And you find the examples of so many of these relationships, where immediately the companions would say, those who were in Medina and receiving the help, the migrants, they would say, I have this much wealth. Half of it is yours. This, I'll keep half for myself and my family. You take this other half. And you see the beautiful ihsan. That ihsan, remember I said that beauty and excellence manifested in everything. The muhajireen, the migrants would say, many would say, oh no, that's too much. And they would embody that beautiful spirit. But also on the other side, those helpers would be so quick to put their own interests and their own agendas to the wayside, in order to cultivate that love and to embody that love and that shared humanity. And that those are the ideals that were central to the beloved community being built. You know, there's my favorite hadith, meaning tradition, of the Prophet, peace and blessings be upon him, that he narrates, is this one that I'll share with you. In which he says that the rights of one another, the rights that you have to one another as brothers in humanity, are five. The first one is that you relay the salam meaning the peace. This is the greeting that we often give. You might have heard this, that assalamu alaikum, salam, shalom, peace. So this is our greeting that we give to one another, and it's a prayer for one another. When you give greetings of peace, you're actually praying that peace descends upon, that God's peace descends upon that person. And when you're praying for God's peace, how can you ever be in a situation where you're having animosity or you're having tension between someone when you're praying for peace? So it's a beautiful spirit. And the Prophet is saying that you have a right, the right to your brother and sister in humanity is that you respond to their salam when it's given. Number two is that you make a prayer when someone sneezes. It's common in our tradition, when someone sneezes, you say, may God have mercy upon you. So when someone sneezes, you say, may God have mercy upon you. Number three is that when someone is sick, you visit them. When someone is sick, you visit them. Number three is when someone invites you to something, you respond to the invitation. And number four is that when someone passes away, you attend and follow their funeral procession. And for the longest time, I didn't understand the deep meaning behind this tradition, this saying of the Prophet, these words of wisdom. Because initially, I was only thinking about it like a checklist. I just do this and I check the box. I do this and I check the box, and I've relieved myself of that. Of those rights and responsibilities. But ultimately, what Islam teaches is that we don't look at the world from a paradigm of rights and responsibilities and duties, but it's rather trying to embody that spirit of beauty and excellence in all things. And so the deeper meaning behind relaying someone's salam when someone gives a greeting is that you give them the love and care and attention that they deserve as your brother or as your sister. That when someone walks into the room, that I don't just neglect them, but that I care for them and I respond to their greeting. Number two, that I respond to someone's sneeze. What is that all about? What's the deeper meaning behind that? And that I respond to someone's when they're sick, I visit them. What the Prophet is teaching us is that our relationship is dependent upon one another, and there's such an intimate relationship that we have to be together from the most mundane of things to the most serious of matters. That when someone sneezes, it might seem insignificant, but you still must be there for your brother or your sister, even in those moments that are mundane. And you must be there in the moments that are serious when someone is ill. that the Prophet teaches us that we must be there to respond to an invitation. When someone is inviting others, they're usually celebrating. We go in, we are together in moments of celebration and joy, and we're also together in moments of sorrow and solace with the passing of someone following the funeral procession. That this is the interconnectedness and interdependence that the Prophet was trying to teach us, that we, in order to foster that beloved community, we must really begin to cultivate that ethos within us and then manifest it within our families and with our communities. And so the ultimate culmination of that beloved community that Prophet Muhammad built was one of great diversity. Diversity across racial lines, diversity across class, diversity across economic standards. That diversity is one that we need to cultivate, and we need to not only tolerate, but we need to move beyond tolerating and move to celebrating. Because that is what the Medinan community was. It was one in which you had Christians and Muslims and Jews and people of other faiths, people that worshipped idols, people that were Zoroastrian roots of worshipping fire. You had this fruit salad, as they say, of all these differences coming together, but understanding these shared principles that we must come to know one another. And this, I forgot to mention this beautiful story in which one of the companions of the Prophet, peace and blessings be upon him, by the name of Salman al-Farisi, in which the Prophet was teaching us really the simple recipe and equation to fostering love amongst one another. And that is coming to know one another. The Prophet, peace and blessings be upon him, Salman al-Farisi, this great companion of his, came on a long journey from Persia. He was originally Persia. Salman al-Farisi means Salman the Persian. And he came on this long journey seeking out truth. And he sought guidance from different people of knowledge that ultimately told them there's going to come a prophet in this place where there's a lot of date palm trees. And that was Medina. And so he came, and ultimately he became a Muslim. But he was an outsider. He was someone that was actually forced into slavery on his travels. And he came to Medina, he made his way as a slave. And ultimately he became Muslim, and he wasn't as well known to folks in the Medinan community because he was a slave, and he wasn't known to folks that were migrating because he wasn't in the same city. But the Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings be upon him, when he met him and when he became Muslim and when he heard of his story and the journey that he went on, he told his companions and he brought his companions together and he said, come and listen to the story of your brother Salman and see the inspiration that he is. And after hearing their story, the group of migrants, the people who migrated from Mecca, were saying, Salman is from us, because he actually migrated from somewhere and he came to Medina. And the Ansar, the helpers who were already based in Medina, were saying, no, he's from the Ansar, he's from our group, because actually he had already settled in Medina and he was already here before. So he was a naturalized Medinan and he's from us. And the Prophet ﷺ, the Prophet peace and blessings be upon him, he said, no, both of you guys are wrong. He's from Ahlul Bayt, meaning the family of the Prophet peace and blessings be upon him. He's from me and my family. So you see this beautiful paradigm where they're now fighting over claiming this brother. And the Prophet, peace be blessed be upon him, this all started with, come and listen to your brother's story. Come to know him. When you come to know him, you'll recognize his humanity. And in recognizing his humanity, you'll come to love him. And in coming to love him, you'll be able to manifest that beautiful spirit of ihsan, of beauty and excellence in all things. So I close with this idea that in that community were Muslims and Jews and Christians and people of other faiths and non-faiths. And they were able to not only tolerate one another, but celebrate each other's differences and recognize that these differences are ultimately a reflection of God and the beautiful mosaic of God, and everything at the end of the day points to God. And community will only be really manifested when we start to address the different societal ills that are at play, particularly that are stemming from individualism and everything being about me. Because that is ultimately the root that leads to arrogance, that leads to many of the ills of capitalism and racism that we previously spoke about. So I leave you with this beautiful quote that I heard from a dear friend of mine just a week or two ago. He said that community is only real if it feels like a fireplace. Community should feel like a fireplace, and that religion should feel like a hug. Religion should feel like a hug. It's simple, but I don't know why it got me. And it should never be a kick in the groin, but it should feel like a hug. And at the end of the day, that's what we're after. That we're after institutions, mosques and churches, and schools and community centers that are not just buildings, mosques and schools and churches with loneliness in between, but rather that we're a community that actually is interconnected. We are interconnected, that's a reality, but that we realize our interconnectedness and that we begin to live out Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s vision of that beloved community. And that beloved community can only be manifested when we start to live with that ihsan, that beauty and excellence within our character and manifested within our hearts, that is then manifested into our outer being and our outer character. Thank you so much.
So we are, as we said in the beginning, Samer is very open to entering into dialogue with those who've heard this presentation. So we're going to do that for a while. But before we do, I want to give Samer just a second to rest and get a drink of something. And I want to recognize there's been talk of this person organized this, that person. There was a lot of people that worked on making this happen, as is true of everything that happens in this church. So if you're on the Social Action Committee or you're on the group of people who organize this event, would you stand just to let people see who that is? Thank you. Okay, so Karen passed out some cards. If you have a question that you'd prefer to put on a card and pass it forward, we can ask it to Samer, or we have a microphone here in the front.
Hi, thank you so much for that. So it is so puzzling to me how Islam gets contorted into something else that is being put forward as aggressive, killing, terroristic. Do you have any insight as to what is it that is creating these contortions?
It's a great question. I can be really loud. No. I promise I can. Can I hear you? I'll promise to be loud enough that everyone should. Everyone in the back can hear me? I don't think it's on either, but I'll be. So, that's a great question. It's one that I get all the time. Number one, I would say, is there is a lot of people that have a vested self-interest in making Islam into a scapegoat in this day and age. And it's nothing new. It's something that... in our American history, there has always been a community of people, whether that be a racial community or a religious community or any other community, that is often the scapegoat of, and they're ultimately made out to be the bad guy for someone's personal agenda and for someone's personal interest. And so it's interesting when you talk about this idea of Islamophobia, this fear of Islam and what it may come with, is an irrational fear, number one, but it's one that is intentionally produced for people to benefit. And so the reason I say that is that in every, leading up to every presidential election, and really any election in general, you see a spike in Islamophobia in terms of actual hate crimes being played out, and also in terms of the media putting forth a narrative that is beneficial to the people that, you know, are controlling the media, because we know that the media in this day and age is not an independent, they're corporations that are backed by certain politicians that have a vested interest in getting votes in the ballot box, and also other corporations that have an interest in getting in maximizing their profits at the end of the year. So it's something that is intentionally driven by people. But at the end of the day, the reason why that reality is so it feels like there's so much hatred for Muslims in this day and age, and it feels like there's so much Islamophobia, and there is, and it's real. At the end of the day, it's a skewed reality in which we don't see, nobody in the outside world sees this space where there's lots of love and lots of community being built. So those spaces are often not given the attention that would often balance the common discourse. And so I would say that we often, you know, it is a reality and it's something that the Muslim community faces, just like so many other communities face. The Muslim community is not special, and actually the reality is that there are other communities still to this day that are facing a lot more oppression and a lot more marginalization, namely the African American community. That's a different lecture series that needs to be addressed, and so many other communities, so many other discriminatory realities that we have, whether it comes to discrimination against other marginalized groups, and we all know, though, there's too many to list, really. So I would say that it's moments like these and other conversations that I have with young people that give me so much hope that there's a different narrative that we can drive forward, and that is one of, you know, everything I just rambled on to you guys about. I hope that kind of... So do I have any keen insights? No, not really. I wouldn't say so. But that's a little bit of commentary on that reality.
I'm aware that in the Muslim faith that there is a distinction between how women are worship and men, and the separation between the two, which is something that really is very puzzling, and especially in these recent days, with more women coming forward and talking about being marginalized and disenfranchised. How do you see that?
Great question. What I would say is, I wish I would have it's a whole subject in and of itself in how understanding, number one, what reality Islam, what socio-political reality it came to in terms of 1400 years ago, the time and place that was, and that's a society that was patriarchal in nature, that was misogynistic in its core institutions and cultures that played out. So we have a history of not only America, not a history of we have a history of the world that marginalized women and made them and didn't ensure their equal rights so Islam came into that world that was much like the rest of our world history, and it actually came and ensured Muslim women's rights, and not Muslim women's rights, but women's rights. But it happened to be that they were Muslim in that community. And so what I mean, some specific examples would be that in that day and age, in that Arab society, in Arabia, 1400 years ago, women, actually baby girls, were actually viewed as being, in some context, a shame to the family. People wanted to have sons, and there was a practice of infanticide, where actually babies would be grotesquely buried alive. You had a situation where Muslim women were actually viewed as property. So when someone actually died, their wife would be inherited by their brother or whatever. So that was the reality that existed. Let alone those existed. Let alone the right to own property, the right to have to participate in a society. Those were if those were at play, then those were far out the window. So Islam came and ensured, number one, it condemned that reality, that practice of viewing women as any lesser than. It affirmed that men and women were equal in the sight of God, the only distinction being what I mentioned before, just like nations and tribes, the only distinction is God consciousness, piety, what actions we cultivate and what actions we bring forth into the world that would be either pleasing or displeasing to God, that would be the only distinction. That women women were given a voice in terms of their testimony actually being valid in a court of law, in terms of the right to own property, in terms of the right to be educated. So the Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings be upon him, is a beautiful example of this, in which his wife, so the Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings be upon him, married when he was 25 years old to his wife Khadija. It's a beautiful love story if you ever want to get some inspiration for anniversary, you want some inspiration, just go look at his story. But in any case, he was 25 and he married his wife when she was 40 years old. And he remarried after she passed away. And while she was alive, he only had one wife. And then later on, that's a different conversation, he took more wives. And that's for, I guess I opened up a can of worms, so I'll have to maybe speak about that. But ultimately, she was actually a successful businesswoman. And it was actually through him working for her that they actually came to know one another and actually came to get married. And so she was a successful, prominent businesswoman who was very powerful in that society, and she had a lot of social capital. And ultimately, she is one of she's not just a token example that I'm giving, but Islam came and ultimately brought forth a level playing field, so that ultimately women and men could seek out opportunities of prospering. Now, the reality is that Islam is the religion that holds these virtues that I'm saying and levels the playing field. But we also live in a world where, there's different dimensions of culture and religion and politics playing out all at once. So when you take religion and apply it to different cultures, then you have, It depends on the culture and it's circumstantial then. So in this day and age, Muslim women in America have... So what I would say is that as a world, we still have a lot of work to do when it comes to gender equality. So we as America, it's a part of our American exceptionalism that we like to think of ourselves as very, very progressive around a lot of different women's issues, but really we're actually still far behind in terms of women being in political power. You look at the House of Representatives and the Senate, where is the equality there? You look at in terms of access to women's resources that they might need, in terms of centers. There's a lot missing there. You know, we like to think of ourselves as very, very progressive, but Pakistan actually has a higher percentage of women in their whatever's equivalent to their political leadership. So we as a society and as a world still have a lot of work to do. And so the Muslim community is just like the rest of the world. But in terms of Islam in America, Muslim women have their rights, so what I'll speak about is my mosque. My mosque, we have women that are on the board, we have women that are on the staff, women in positions of leadership, women in positions of influence. We often have women come and give presentations and give sermons and give, you know, community. They're part and parcel of the community. When we have community seminars and sessions, you'll have men and women sitting side by side. It's only when it comes to the specific prayer, ritual prayer, which is that men are in the front and women are in the back. And this is not a matter of equality. It's a matter of comfort and function of the prayer. So when we come to pray, our sole purpose is really immersing ourselves in the remembrance of God and being really in, you know, having a communication with God. And so it's partly a function of minimizing distractions, that men wouldn't be either praying in front of, praying behind or even on the side of women, so that they wouldn't serve as a distraction. I mentioned I was a psychology major. Psychology would suggest that men and women are very different, many different ways. And a part of that is the way that they're attracted to one another, that men tend to be more visually inclined and visually stimulated, as opposed to women that maybe it's that's not to say that they're not visually inclined towards men, but that they might be more inclined towards feelings or towards touch, etc., etc. The psychology research would suggest that. So and just to be very blunt, you know, unless it's like a baseball player with like some really tight pants, generally a woman is not going to be distracted by looking at the behind of a man. Like me, you know, whereas the opposite is not necessarily true. Even seeing the silhouette of a woman, even just seeing the silhouette, nothing more than a silhouette can be a distraction for men. So men are, you know, my mentor used to say men are dogs, and I don't fully agree with him, but he was onto something. So ultimately, it's a function of the prayer in that you're coming to worship God and to minimize distractions. It's also, number two, for reasons of modesty and for the comfort of women themselves. Because a part of our motions is that you get down into positions and your backside is revealed. You prostrate with your head on the ground, and that leaves your backside vulnerable to the gaze of men or whoever. So for women's comfort, it's also something that protects that piece. In our space in ISPCC, if you ever come, women actually pray in the back. There's also an upstairs where women can pray even more comfortable, where nobody could see them. And then there's also a right side where women can also, we try to actually have women pray on the right side. So there's men and then there's women on the right side. And that's just a unique for means of security, because we don't want, our entrances are in the back. And so so that our women are not immediately vulnerable if there was anything, anything were to go awry. So that's the specific reason as to why women pray in the back, behind women. And it's a part of our culture that we associate positive things with being in the front and negative things with being in the back. But the reality is that, you know, Rosa Parks was on the bus, and being in the back of the bus was an inconvenience. I mean, the door is right here, and you have to be inconvenienced to go there, and then you have to be inconvenienced. That's a different story. But for some reason, there's actually beauty to the reality of having a front and a back. So if you ever go to the mosque, and you'll see like, or any sort of designs, oftentimes you need the back and the front to actually manifest the beauty. If you only had one or the other, you wouldn't be able to appreciate the beauty. And so we as a society have these inclinations to put more value than there is on just being in the front superficially. So that's. I hope that answers the question.
Hi, I'm just going to read a question from John Thompson. How can I get a copy of your lecture?
I don't have the answer to that. I can share my notes, but other than that, is it recorded?
Google it. Yes, there's a voice recording that will be available on the website.
Thank you for that answer.
You're welcome, even though I didn't give the answer. Thank you so much.
Hi, thank you very much for your lecture. You talked a lot about Islam's injunctions to love. And Unitarian Universalism is a tradition that welcomes many, many, all faiths. And we welcome the teachings to love. Standing on the side of love is one of our slogans. But as a tradition, we're also very, very interested in working on the mechanisms that interfere with solidarity and love with other people and affecting the power structures that impact that. And I know that Islam is a religion of, they say, deen and dunya, of religion and the world. So I'm wondering from your perspective, what are the worldly or secular mechanisms that you as a Muslim embrace to help people get to the situation that you're describing with your injunction towards love?
Great question, thank you so much. Yeah, so in order for us to really, I mentioned that the beauty, the diversity ultimately points to God in my lecture. And ultimately, in order for us to, our sole purpose in life is to worship God and to seek His pleasure. And to worship God is to know God. And in order for someone to really meaningfully have a relationship with God and find comfort in spirituality and faith, then they have to have their basic needs met. So you can't, you know, someone that doesn't have basic security, they don't have a home where they can find solace in and go to at the end of the day and find comfort in and feel safe, then they're not going to be able to really experience the beauties that faith has to offer. Someone that doesn't have their basic, you know, necessities of food and drink. It's the same example of school. You have children that are going to school hungry. How can you expect them to succeed when it comes to school when their tummies are empty and they're hungry? So the same way, you know, we want to facilitate justice ultimately. That God, we believe, is the most just. And He's the perfect enactor of justice, and that ultimately He gave us this world to build, and it's our responsibility to be vicegerents of God, representatives of God, emissaries of God. How do you be a representative of someone? You represent what they stand for, and what God stands for is justice. And so that virtue is something that we have to seek, and we have to work to build towards. It's not something that we just say, oh, you know, we trust in God and God will fix all our problems. No, God tasked us with, and He gave us the responsibility and the power and the authority to move about this world in different ways. And so the reality is that the culture of individualism that has been, you know, that is manifested in this day and age ultimately was manifested in a different way, or I wouldn't call it individualism, but it was having the self at the center and my family and my tribe has led to many injustices across, you know, throughout our world history, and we don't need to name them. So in this common society, we have injustice. I mentioned the African-American community. You have the prison industrial complex. You have different institutions, structural realities that provide advantages to some more than others. So we have so many different causes that we have to champion and that we have to work towards. And ultimately, our philosophy, as Muslims, our core belief is that we have to do the work, and ultimately the results aren't in our hands. We take the necessary means, and then we put our trust in God. And so we have a responsibility to take those means. And that means working towards equality and justice around many different arenas. So ensuring that we have marginalized communities that don't have the necessary resources to be successful or to be as successful, and ensuring that we right those wrongs. We have the Native American communities that have been just for decades upon decades neglected and marginalized and continue to this day. You have the example of the pipe, you know, the Keystone pipeline that recently actually burst, and now there's that tragedy and that disaster. So we, as individuals, as a society, really need to push this narrative, this social justice narrative, and Islam is really all for that social justice narrative. There are some, you know, there's some differences that Islam would come and wouldn't agree with the entirety of a Western liberal social justice paradigm, but ultimately, that's where we really need to, that's actually how we can foster more love, is when you have a shared mission, when you have a shared vision, and you're working towards it, that's actually what really fosters and solidifies. So you come to know one another, like I mentioned, but then you start really working together, and that's what really solidifies that beloved community. So, so much work needs to be done, and that's why we need to really come together. I hope that answered the question.
One or two more.
Yeah. I guess so many of the things that you say, I think I and most of the people here will agree with as far as fostering the challenges, building a beloved community, wealth needs to be shared, that people are equal and so forth. All of those things are easy. Where I have a problem, I'm an atheist. And I think I'm not the only atheist here. And so my feeling for this, these goals of the beloved community come from a totally different place than yours do. And I hope we can still work together. I don't know if I can ask this as a question, but that's where every time you say, we're going to get this because of God, then, you know, I'm somewhere else. But in all of the other goals you've stated, I'm with you 100%.
Absolutely. And that's where ultimately I referenced a little bit about, you know, faith, non-faith as well. And whatever ultimately what it comes down to is that we have to have, number one is mutual respect. It starts with mutual respect. And then moving past respect into coming to know. So not being so dogmatic about your own beliefs and that it's my way is the only way, but that being open to work together. So we have to come as whole individuals together. That I'm fully a Muslim. When I'm given a microphone, I'm going to talk about God. That's just me. And we have to embrace one another fully. And we have to come and say, you know, you have your beliefs and I have my beliefs. And how can we, number one, where do we align? Because you said we align on a lot of things. The difference is the source of, you know, or the source or the reason or the why at the end of the day, but the what we agree on. And so we can come together and work together to build that world. And ultimately, the why at the end of the day as Muslims, it's actually our belief that we can't even know the intentions of as Muslims, as a Muslim community, I don't know what the intentions of the person working next to me are. I assume the best of intentions of that person, but at the end of the day, only God knows what that person's intentions are. And so I even work almost with a similar paradigm with the Muslim next to me, that at the end of the day, my worldview is that we're all tools of God, that are working in this world to build a better future for God. That's my language. We have to come wholly together. And when there's another context, you know, so I don't apologize for being who I am, and that means speaking about God a lot. I mentioned him at least 20 times in the last 20 seconds. But we have to overlook that and not be so stuck in our ways to be able to come together to build a partnership. That partnership is based on mutual respect, and then mutual respect ultimately turns into love. Because you can have love, it's ultimately, you have love based on, love is cultivated based on shared realities. And so you can have a love that's based on a shared love for anything, for a love of, shared love of God, shared love of football, shared love of food. I have a lot of my closest friends are because we, growing up, we used to play football together. Many of them are of many different faiths. So when we have that shared vision and mission, we can come together, and that will ultimately cultivate that love, and then get to impact, which is really what we want.
Anecdotally, I think it's important to approach any religion from your heart, not so much from the critical faculties. I think there's always time to find what you will agree with and disagree with, but I don't think you can get there unless you open your heart first and approach that that way. I came to Islam many years ago because I found it to be very inclusive and to be very beautiful. I found that the Prophet Sallallahu Alaihi Wasallam was a very beautiful teacher and an open-hearted person. I love the story in particular because you know my animal feelings. When he was sleeping and resting and the cat was lying on his robe, he didn't want to disturb the cat, so he cut a hole in the robe around the cat and moved forward rather than disturb the sleeping beauty. If you read the Quran just simply as best you can, the story of Mary giving birth to Jesus is just powerful. It's sweet, it's loving, it's open-hearted, and as is the Quran's acceptance of Jesus and all of the world's great prophets. So if you begin, as I do anyway, accepting from a perspective of love that this is a loving religion, as I think finally all religions are, then afterwards my critical faculties can come into play and I can say, yeah, but what about this? What about women's rights? And you know, you get to that point eventually, but I don't think that's the beginning point. I think the beginning point is here, and then you move outward. As a concentric circle, I think someone said, maybe the hadith, that God is a circle whose circumference is everywhere, but whose center is the human heart. Shukran, salam.
We believe it's very important that we have an opportunity to interact more directly and socially with Samer in our reception. So, with your permission, I think we'll pass now to the next part of the activity, if that's okay.
Yeah. I just want to thank Samer again for being with us, for helping expand our awareness and knowledge and appreciation for your tradition, and how we can be in relationship with each other going forward. I hope that as communities in the greater Boston area, we can build on this relationship and maybe do more of that justice work together and further that getting to know each other and working towards beloved community together. Thank you. As a small token, we have lots of information about Theodore Parker right here for you.